one, or if not the right one, at least the compassionate one. He would do what he could for Judd now, and if it meant being best man at the death of his wife, he would be that. "On my way," he said, and hung up. 32. It had not been a heart attack. It had been a cerebral accident, sudden and probably painless. When Lewis called Steve Masterton that afternoon and told him what was going on, Steve said that he wouldn't mind going out just that way. "Sometimes God dillies and dallies," Steve said, "and sometimes he just points at you and tells you to hang up your jock." Rachel did not want to talk about it at all and would not allow Lewis to talk to her of it. Ellie was not so much upset as she was surprised and interested. It was what Lewis thought a thoroughly healthy 6-year-old reaction should be. She wanted to know if Mrs. Crandall had died with her eyes open or shut. Lewis said he didn't know. Judd took hold as well as could have been expected, considering the fact that the lady had been sharing bed and board with him for almost 60 years. Lewis found the old man, and on this day he looked very much like an old man of 83, sitting alone at the kitchen table, smoking a Chesterfield, drinking a bottle of beer, and staring blankly into the living room. He looked up when Lewis came in and said, "Well, she's gone, Lewis." He said this in such a clear and matter-of-fact way that Lewis thought it must not have really cleared through all the circuits yet, hadn't hit him yet where he lived. Then Judd's mouth began to work, and he covered his eyes with one arm. Lewis went to him and put an arm around him. Judd gave in and wept. It had cleared the circuits all right. Judd understood perfectly. His wife had died. "That's good," Lewis said. "That's good, Judd. She would want you to cry a little, I think. Probably be pissed off if you didn't." He had started to cry a little himself. Judd hugged him tightly, and Lewis hugged him back. Judd cried for 10 minutes or so, and then the storm passed. Lewis listened to the things Judd said then with great care. He listened as a doctor as well as a friend. He listened for any circularity in Judd's conversation. He listened to see if Judd's grasp of when was clear. No need to check him on where. That would prove nothing, because for Judd Crandall the where had always been Ludlow, Maine. He listened most of all for any use of Norma's name in the present tense. He found little or no sign that Judd was losing his grip. Lewis was aware that it was not uncommon for two old married people to go almost hand in hand, a month, a week, even a day apart. The shock, he supposed, or maybe even some deep inner urge to catch up with the one gone. That was a thought he would not have had before church. He found that many of his thoughts concerning the spiritual and the supernatural had undergone a quiet but nonetheless deep sea change. His conclusion was that Judd was grieving hard, but that he was still compos mentis. He sensed in Judd none of that transparent frailty that had seemed to surround Norma on New Year's Eve, when the four of them had sat in the Creed living room drinking eggnog. Judd brought him a beer from the fridge, his face still red and blotchy from crying.
"A bit early in the day," he said, "but the sun's over the yardarm somewhere in the world and under the circumstances."
"Say no more," Lewis told him and opened the beer. He looked at Judd. "Shall we drink to her?"
"I guess we better," Judd said. "You should have seen her when she was 16, Lewis, coming back from church with her jacket unbuttoned. Your eyes would have popped. She could have made the devil swear off drinking. Thank Christ she never asked me to do it."
Lewis nodded and raised his beer a little. "To Norma," he said. Judd clinked his bottle against Lewis's. He was crying again, but he was also smiling. He nodded.
"May she have peace, and let there be no friggin' arthritis wherever she is."
"Amen," Lewis said, and they drank. It was the only time Lewis saw Judd progress beyond a mild tipsiness, and even so he did not become incapacitated. He reminisced, a constant stream of warm memories and anecdotes, colorful and clear and sometimes arresting, flowed from him. Yet between the stories of the past, Judd dealt with the present in a way Lewis could only admire. If it had been Rachel who had simply dropped dead after her grapefruit and morning cereal, he wondered if he could have done half so well. Judd called the Brookings Smith Mortuary in Bangor and made as many of the arrangements as he could by telephone. He made an appointment to come in the following day and make the rest. Yes, he would have her embalmed. He wanted her an address, which he would provide. Yes, he would pick out underwear. No, he did not want the mortuary to supply the special shoes which laced up the back. Would they have someone wash her hair? He asked. She washed it last on Monday night, and so it had been dirty when she died. He listened, and Lewis, whose uncle had been in what those in the business called the quiet trade, knew the undertaker was telling Judd that a final wash and set was part of the service rendered. Judd nodded and thanked the man he was talking to, then listened again. Yes, he said, he would have her cosmeticized, but it was to be a lightly applied layer. She's dead and people know it, he said, lighting a Chesterfield. No need to tot her up. The coffin would be closed during the funeral, he told the director with calm authority, but open during the visiting hours the day before. She was to be buried in Mount Hope Cemetery, where they had bought plots in 1951. He had the papers in hand and gave the mortician the plot number so that the preparations could begin out there. H-101. He himself had H-102, he told Lewis later on. He hung up, looked at Lewis, and said, "Prettiest cemetery in the world is right here in Bangor, as far as I'm concerned. Crack yourself another beer if you want, Lewis. All of this is gonna take a while." Lewis was about to refuse, he was feeling a little tiddly, when a grotesque image arose unbidden behind his eyes. Judd, pulling Norma's corpse on a pagan litter through the woods, toward the Micmac burying ground beyond the pet cemetery. It had the effect of a slap on him. Without a word, he got up and got another beer out of the fridge. Judd nodded at him and dialed the telephone again. By 3 that afternoon, when Lewis went home for a sandwich and a bowl of soup, Judd had progressed a long way toward organizing his wife's final rites. He moved from one thing to the next like a man planning a dinner party of some importance. He called the North Ludlow Methodist Church, where the actual funeral would take place, and the cemetery administration office at Mount Hope. These were both calls the undertaker at Brookings Smith would be making, but Judd called first as a courtesy. It was a step few bereaved ever thought of, or if they thought of it, one they could rarely bring themselves to take. Lewis admired Judd all the more for it. Later, he called Norma's few surviving relatives and his own, paging through an old and tattered address book with a leather cover to find the numbers. And between calls, he drank beer and remembered the past. Lewis felt great admiration for him. And love? Yes, his heart confirmed. And love. When Ellie came down that night in her pajamas to be kissed, she asked Lewis if Mrs. Crandall would go to heaven. She almost whispered the question to Lewis, as if she understood it would be better if they were not overheard. Rachel was in the kitchen making a chicken pie, which she intended to take over to Judd the next day. Across the street, all the lights were on in the Crandall house. Cars were parked in Judd's driveway, and up and down the shoulder of the highway on that side for 100 feet in either direction. The official viewing hours would be tomorrow at the mortuary, but tonight people had come to comfort Judd as well as they could, and to help him remember, and to celebrate Norma's passing. What Judd had referred to once that afternoon as the foregoing. Between that house and this, a frigid February wind blew. The road was patched with black ice. The coldest part of the main winter was now upon them. "Well, I don't really know, honey," Lewis said, taking Ellie on his lap. On the TV, a running gunfight was in progress. A man spun and dropped, unremarked upon by either of them. Lewis was aware, uncomfortably so, that Ellie probably knew a hell of a lot more about Ronald McDonald and Spider-Man and the Burger King than she did about Moses, Jesus, and St. Paul. She was the daughter of a woman who was a non-practicing Jew and a man who was a lapsed Methodist, and he supposed her ideas about the whole Spiritus Mundi were of the vaguest sort, not myths, not dreams, but dreams of dreams. "It's late for that," he thought randomly. "She's only 5, but it's late for that. Jesus, it gets late so fast." But Ellie was looking at him, and he ought to say something. "People believe all sorts of things about what happens to us when we die," he said. "Some people think we go to heaven or hell. Some people believe we're born again as little children."
"Sure, carnation. Like what happened to Audrey Rose in that movie on TV."
"You never saw that." Rachel, he thought, would have her own cerebral accident if she thought Ellie had seen Audrey Rose.
"Marie told me at school," Ellie said.
Marie was Ellie's self-proclaimed best friend, a malnourished, dirty little girl, who always looked as if she might be on the edge of impetigo or ringworm, or perhaps even scurvy. Both Lewis and Rachel encouraged the friendship as well as they could, but Rachel had once confessed to Lewis that, after Marie left, she always felt an urge to check Ellie's head for nits and headlice. Lewis had laughed and nodded.
"Marie's mommy lets her watch all the shows."
There was an implied criticism in this that Lewis chose to ignore. "Well, it's reincarnation, but I guess you've got the idea. The Catholics believe in heaven and hell, but they also believe there's a place called Limbo and one called Purgatory. And the Hindus and Buddhists believe in Nirvana." There was a shadow on the dining room wall. Rachel, listening. Lewis went on more slowly. "There are probably lots more, too. But what it comes down to, Ellie, is this. No one knows. People say they know, but when they say that, what they mean is that they believe because of faith. Do you know what faith is?"
"Well..."
"Here we are, sitting in my chair," Lewis said. "Do you think my chair will still be here tomorrow?"
"Yeah, sure."
"Then you have faith it will be here." "As it so happens, I do too. Faith is believing a thing will be, or is. Get it?"
"Yes,"
Ellie nodded positively. "But we don't know it'll be here. After all, some crazed chair burglar might break in and take it, right?" Ellie giggled. Lewis smiled. "We just have faith that won't happen. Faith is a great thing, and really religious people would like us to believe that faith and knowing are the same thing, but I don't believe that myself, because there are too many different ideas on the subject. What we know is this. When we die, one of two things happens. Either our souls and thoughts somehow survive the experience of dying, or they don't. If they do, that opens up every possibility you could think of. If we don't, it's just blotto. The end."
"Like going to sleep?"
He considered this and then said, "More like having ether, I think."
"Which do you have faith in, Daddy?"
The shadow on the wall moved and came to rest again. For most of his adult life, since college days, he supposed, he had believed that death was the end. He had been present at many deathbeds, and had never felt a soul bullet past him on its way to wherever. Hadn't this very thought occurred to him upon the death of Victor Pascal? He had agreed with his Psychology 1 teacher that the life-after-death experiences reported in scholarly journals and then vulgarized in the popular press probably indicate a last-ditch mental stand against the onrush of death, the endlessly inventive human mind staving off insanity to the very end by constructing a hallucination of immortality. He had likewise agreed with an acquaintance in the dorm who had said, during an all-night bull session during Lewis's sophomore year at Chicago, that the Bible was suspiciously full of miracles which had ceased almost completely during the age of rationality. "Totally ceased," he had said at first, but had been forced backward at least one step by others who claimed with some authority that there were still plenty of weird things going on, little pockets of perplexity in a world that had become by and large a clean, well-lighted place. There was, for instance, the Shroud of Turin, which had survived every effort to debunk it. So Christ brought Lazarus back from the dead, this acquaintance, who had gone on to become a highly thought-of OB man in Dearborn, Michigan, had said. That's fine with me. If I have to swallow it, I will. I mean, I had to buy the concept that the fetus of one twin can sometimes swallow the fetus of the other in utero, like some kind of unborn cannibal, and then show up with teeth in his testes or in his lungs 20 or 30 years later to prove that he did it. And I suppose if I can buy that, I can buy anything. But I want to see the death certificate. You dig what I'm saying? I'm not questioning that he came out of the tomb, but I want to see the original death certificate. I'm like Thomas saying he'd only believe Jesus had risen when he could look through the nail holes and stick his hand in the guy's side. As far as I'm concerned, he was the real physician of the bunch, not Luke. No, he had never really believed in survival. At least not until church. I believe that we go on, he told his daughter slowly. But as to what it's like, I have no opinion. It may be that it's different for different people. It may be that you get what you believed all your life. But I believe we go on, and I believe that Mrs. Crandall is probably someplace where she can be happy.
You have faith in that, Ellie said. It was not a question. She sounded awed. Lewis smiled, a little pleased and a little embarrassed.
I suppose so. And I have faith that it's time for you to go to bed, like 10 minutes ago. He kissed her twice, once on the lips and once on the nose.
Do you think animals go on?
Yes, he said, without thinking, and for a moment he almost added, especially cats. The words had actually trembled on his lips for a moment, and his skin felt gray and cold.
Okay, she said and slid down. Gotta go kiss Mommy.
Right on. He watched her go. At the dining room doorway, she turned back and said,
I was really silly about church that day, wasn't I? Crying like that.
No, hon, he said. I don't think you were silly.
If he died now, I could take it, she said,
and then seemed to consider the thought she had just spoken aloud as if mildly startled. Then she said, as if agreeing with herself, sure I could, and went to find Rachel. Later in bed, Rachel said,
I heard what you were talking about with her.
And you don't approve? Lewis asked. He had decided that maybe it would be best to have this out, if that was what Rachel wanted.
No,
Rachel said, with a hesitance that was not much like her.
No, Lewis, it's not like that. I just get scared. And you know me. When I get scared, I get defensive.
Lewis could not remember ever hearing Rachel speak with such effort, and suddenly he felt more cautious than he had with Ellie earlier. He felt that he was in a minefield. Scared of what? Dying?
Not myself, she said. I hardly even think about that anymore. But when I was a kid, I thought of it a lot, lost a lot of sleep, dreamed of monsters coming to eat me up in my bed. And all of the monsters looked like my sister, Zelda.
Yes, Lewis thought. Here it is. At last, after all the time we've been married, here it is.
You don't talk about her much, he said.
Rachel smiled and touched his face.
You're sweet, Lewis. I never talk about her. I try never to think about her.
I always assumed you had your reasons.
I did. I do.
She paused, thinking. I know she died. Spinal meningitis.
Spinal meningitis, she repeated. There are no pictures of her in the house anymore.
There's a picture of a young girl. In your father's.
In his study. Yes, I forgot that one. And my mother carries one in her wallet still, I think. She was 2 years older than I was. She caught it
and she was in the back bedroom. She was in the back bedroom like a dirty secret. Louis, she was dying in there. My sister died in the back bedroom. And that's what she was. A dirty secret. She was always a dirty secret.
Rachel suddenly broke down completely, and in the loud, rising quality of her sobs, Louis sensed the onset of hysteria and became alarmed. He reached for her and caught a shoulder, which was pulled away from him as soon as he touched it. He could feel the whisper of her nightdress under his fingertips.
"Rachel, babe, don't tell me don't," she said. "Don't stop me, Louis. I've only got the strength to tell this once, and then I don't want to ever talk about it again. I probably won't sleep tonight as it is."
"Was it that horrible?" he asked, knowing the answer already. It explained so much, and even things he had never connected before, or only suspected vaguely, suddenly came together in his mind. She had never attended a funeral with him, he realized. Not even that of Al Locke, a fellow med student who had been killed when his motorcycle had collided with a city bus. Al had been a regular visitor at their apartment, and Rachel had always liked him, yet she had not gone to his funeral.
"She was sick that day," Louis remembered suddenly. "Got the flu or something. Looked serious. But the next day she was okay again."
"After the funeral she was all right again," he corrected himself. He remembered thinking even then that her sickness might just be psychosomatic.
"It was horrible, all right. Worse than you can ever imagine. Louis, we watched her degenerate day by day, and there was nothing anyone could do. She was in constant pain. Her body seemed to shrivel, pull in on itself. Her shoulders hunched up and her face pulled down until it was like a mask. Her hands were like bird's feet. I had to feed her sometimes. I hated it, but I did it and never said boo about it. When the pain got bad enough, they started giving her drugs. Mild ones at first, and then ones that would have left her a junkie if she had lived. But of course everyone knew she wasn't going to live. I guess that's why she's such a secret to all of us. Because we wanted her to die. Louis, we wished for her to die. And it wasn't just so she wouldn't feel any more pain, it was so we wouldn't feel any more pain. It was because she was starting to look like a monster. And she was starting to be a monster. Oh, Christ, I know how awful that must sound."
She put her face in her hands. Louis touched her gently. "Rachel, it doesn't sound awful at all."
"It does," she cried. "It does."
"It just sounds true," he said. "Victims of long illnesses often become demanding, unpleasant monsters. The idea of the saint-like, long-suffering patient is a big romantic fiction. By the time the first set of sores crops up on a bed-bound patient's butt, he, or she, has started to snipe and cut and spread the misery. They can't help it. But that doesn't help the people in the situation." She looked at him amazed, almost hopeful. Then distrust stole back into her face.
"You're making that up."
He smiled grimly.
"Want me to show you the textbooks? How about the suicide statistics? Want to see those? In families where a terminal patient has been nursed at home, the suicide statistics spike right up into the stratosphere in the 6 months following the patient's death."
"Suicide?"
"They swallow pills or sniff a pipe or blow their brains out. Their hate, their weariness, their disgust, their sorrow." He shrugged and brought his closed fists gently together. "The survivors start feeling as if they'd committed murder, so they step out." A crazy, wounded kind of relief had crept into Rachel's puffy face.
"She was demanding, hateful. Sometimes she'd piss in her bed deliberately. My mother would ask her if she wanted help getting to the bathroom, and later, when she couldn't get up anymore, if she wanted the bedpan. And Zelda would say no. And then she'd piss the bed so my mother, or my mother and I, would have to change the sheets.
and she'd say it was an accident, but you could see the smile in her eyes, Lewis. You could see it. The room always smelled of piss and her drugs. She had bottles of some dope that smelled like Smith Brothers Wild Cherry cough drops, and that smell was always there. Some nights I wake up. Even now, I wake up and I think I can smell Wild Cherry cough drops, and I think, if I'm not really awake, I think, is Zelda dead yet? Is she? I think... Rachel caught her breath. Lewis took her hand and she squeezed his fingers with savage, brilliant tightness. When we changed her, you could see the way her back was twisting and nodding. Near the end, Lewis, near the end, it seemed like her ass had somehow gotten all the way up to the middle of her back. Now Rachel's eyes had taken on the glassy, horrified look of a child, remembering a recurrent nightmare of terrible power. And sometimes she'd touch me with her hands, her birdie hands. And sometimes I'd almost scream and ask her not to. And once I spilled some of her soup on my arm when she touched my face and I burned myself, and that time I did scream. And I cried, and I could see the smile in her eyes then, too. Near the end, the drug stopped working. She was the one who would scream then, and none of us could remember the way she was before, not even my mother. She was just this foul, hateful, screaming thing in the back bedroom. Our dirty secret. Rachel swallowed. Her throat clicked. My parents were gone when she finally... When she... With terrible, wrenching effort, Rachel brought it out. When she died, my parents were gone. They were gone, but I was with her. It was Passover season, and they went out for a while to see some friends. Just for a few minutes. I was reading a magazine in the kitchen. Well, I was looking at it anyway. I was waiting for it to be time to give her some more medicine because she was screaming. She'd been screaming ever since my folks left, almost. I couldn't read with her screaming that way. And then, see, what happened was, well, Zelda stopped screaming. Lewis, I was 8. Bad dreams every night. I had started to think she hated me because my back was straight, because I didn't have the constant pain, because I could walk, because I was going to live. I started to imagine she wanted to kill me. Only even now, tonight, Lewis, I don't really think it was all my imagination. I do think she hated me. I don't really think she would have killed me, but if she could have taken over my body some way, turned me out of it like in a fairy story, I think she would have done that. But when she stopped screaming, I went in to see if everything was all right, to see if she had fallen over on her side or slipped off her pillows. I got in, and I looked at her, and I thought she must have swallowed her own tongue and she was choking to death. Lewis, Rachel's voice rose again, teary and frighteningly childish, as if she were regressing, reliving the experience. Lewis, I didn't know what to do. I was 8. No, of course you didn't, Lewis said. He turned to her and hugged her, and Rachel gripped him with the panicky strength of a poor swimmer whose boat has suddenly overturned in the middle of a large lake. Did someone actually give you a hard time about it, babe?
No,
she said. No one blamed me, but no one could make it better either. No one could change it. No one could make it an unhappening, Lewis. She hadn't swallowed her tongue. She started making a sound, a kind of, I don't know, like that. In her distressed, total recall of that day, she did a more than credible imitation of the way her sister Zelda must have sounded, and Lewis's mind flashed to Victor Pascal. His grip on his wife tightened, and there was spit coming down her chin. Rachel, that's enough, he said, not quite steadily. I am aware of the symptoms.
I'm explaining, she said stubbornly. I'm explaining why I can't go to poor Norma's funeral, for one thing, and why we had that stupid fight that day.
Shh, that's forgotten.
Not by me, it isn't, she said. I remember it well, Lewis. I remember it as well as I remember my sister Zelda choking to death in her bed on April 14, 1965.
For a long moment, there was silence in the room.
I turned her over on her belly and thumped her back, Rachel went on at last. It's all I knew to do. Her feet were beating up and down, and her twisted legs. And I remember there was a sound like farting. I thought she was farting, or I was. But it wasn't farts. It was the seams under both arms of my blouse ripping out when I turned her over. She started to convulse, and I saw that her face was turned sideways, turned into the pillows, and I thought, oh, she's choking. Zelda's choking. And they'll come home and say I murdered her by choking. They'll say, you hated her, Rachel. And that was true. And they'll say you wanted her to be dead, and that was true too. Because, Louis, see, the first thought that went through my mind when she started to go up and down in the bed like that, I remember it. My first thought was, oh, good, finally, Zelda's choking and this is going to be over. So I turned her over again, and her face had gone black, Louis, and her eyes were bulging and her neck was swelled up. Then she died. I backed across the room. I guess I wanted to back out the door, but I hit the wall and a picture fell down. It was a picture from one of the Oz books that Zelda liked before she got sick with the meningitis, when she was well. It was a picture of Oz the Great and Terrible, only Zelda always called him Oz the Great and Terrible because she couldn't make that sound, and so she sounded like Elmer Fudd. My mother got that picture framed because Zelda liked it most of all. Oz the Great and Terrible, and it fell down and hit the floor, and the glass in the frame shattered. And I started to scream because I knew she was dead, and I guess I thought it was her ghost coming back to get me. And I knew that her ghost would hate me like she did, but her ghost wouldn't be stuck in bed, so I screamed. I screamed and I ran out of the house, screaming, Zelda's dead! Zelda's dead! Zelda's dead! And the neighbors, they came and they looked. They saw me running down the street with my blouse all ripped out under the arms. I was yelling, Zelda's dead, Louis, and I guess maybe they thought I was crying, but I think maybe I was laughing, Louis. I think maybe that's what I was doing.
If you were, I salute you for it, Louis said.
You don't mean that, though, Rachel said with the utter surety of one who has been over a point and over it and over it.
He let it go. He thought she might eventually get rid of this awful, rancid memory that had haunted her for so long. Most of it, anyway. But never this part. Never completely. Louis Creed was no psychiatrist, but he knew that there are rusty, half-buried things in the terrain of any life, and that human beings seem compelled to go back to these things and pull at them, even though they cut. Tonight, Rachel had pulled almost all of it out, like some grotesque and stinking rotten tooth, its crown black, its nerves infected, its roots fetid. It was out. Let that last noxious cell remain. If God was good, it would remain dormant except in her deepest dreams. That she had been able to remove as much as she had was well-nigh incredible. It did not just speak of her courage. It clarioned it. Louis was in awe of her. He felt like cheering. He sat up now and turned on the light. Yes, he said, I salute you for it. And if I needed another reason to really dislike your mother and father, I've got it now. You never should have been left alone with her, Rachel. Never. Like a child, the child of 8 she had been when this dirty, incredible thing had happened, she reprimanded him.
Lou, it was Passover season.
I don't care if it was Judgment Trump, Louis said, with a sudden low and hoarse savagery that caused her to pull back a little. He was remembering the student nurses, those 2 candy stripers, whose evil luck it had been to be in attendance on the morning Pascal had been brought in dying. One of them, a tough little lady named Carla Shavers, had returned the next day and had worked out so well that even Charlton was impressed. The other they had never seen again. Louis was not surprised and did not blame her.
Where was the nurse? There should have been an RN in attendance.
They went out, they actually went out, and left an 8-year-old kid in charge of her dying sister, who was probably clinically insane by then. Why? Because it was Passover season, and because elegant Dory Goldman couldn't stand the stink that particular morning and had to get away from it for just a little while. So Rachel got the duty. Right, friends and neighbors, Rachel got the duty. 8 years old, pigtails, midi blouse, Rachel got the duty. Rachel could stay and put up with the stink. What did they send her to Camp Sunset in Vermont for 6 weeks every year if not to put up with the stink of her dying insane sister? 10 new shirt and jumper combinations for Gage and 6 new dresses for Ellie, and I'll pay your way through medical school if you'll stay away from my daughter. But where was the overflowing checkbook when your daughter was dying of spinal meningitis and your other daughter was alone with her, you bastard? Where was the R-fucking-N? Lewis sat up, got out of bed. Where are you going? Rachel asked, alarmed. To get you a Valium. You know I don't tonight, you do, he said. She took the pill and then told him the rest. Her voice remained calm throughout. The tranquilizer was doing its job. The next-door neighbor had retrieved 8-year-old Rachel from behind a tree, where she was crouching and screaming, "Zelda's dead," over and over. Rachel's nose had been bleeding. She had blood all over her. The same neighbor had called the ambulance and then her parents. After getting Rachel's nosebleed stopped and calming her with a cup of hot tea and 2 aspirins, she was able to get the location of her parents out of her. They were visiting Mr. and Mrs. Cabron across town. Peter Cabron was an accountant in her father's business. By that evening, great changes had taken place in the Goldman household. Zelda was gone. Her room had been cleaned and fumigated. All of the furniture was gone. The room was a bare box. Later, much later, it had become Dory Goldman's sewing room. The first of the nightmares had come to Rachel that night, and when Rachel woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning, screaming for her mother, she had been horrified to discover that she could barely get out of bed. Her back was in agony. She had strained it moving Zelda. In her spurt of adrenaline-powered strength, she had, after all, lifted Zelda with enough force to pull her own blouse apart. That she had strained herself trying to keep Zelda from choking was simple. Obvious. Elementary, my dear Watson. To everyone, that was, except Rachel herself. Rachel had been sure that this was Zelda's revenge from beyond the grave. Zelda knew that Rachel was glad she was dead. Zelda knew that when Rachel burst from the house telling all and sundry, Zelda's dead, at the top of her voice, she had been laughing, not screaming. Zelda knew she had been murdered, and so had given Rachel spinal meningitis, and soon Rachel's back would start to twist and change, and she too would have to lie in bed, slowly but surely turning into a monster, her hands hooking into claws. After a while, she would begin screaming with the pain, as Zelda had done, and then she would start wetting the bed, and finally she would choke to death on her own tongue. It was Zelda's revenge. No one could talk Rachel out of this belief, not her mother, her father, or Dr. Murray, who diagnosed a mild back sprain and then told Rachel brusquely, cruelly, some, Lewis, for instance, would have said, to stop behaving so badly. She ought to remember that her sister had just died, Dr. Murray had told her. Her parents were prostrate with grief, and this was not the time for Rachel to make a childish play for attention. Only the slowly abating pain had been able to convince her that she was neither the victim of Zelda's supernatural vengeance nor God's just punishment of the wicked. For months, or so she told Lewis, it had actually been years, 8 of them, afterward, she would awaken from nightmares in which her sister died over and over again, and in the dark Rachel's hands would fly to her back to make sure it was all right. In the frightful aftermath of these dreams, she often thought that the closet door would bang open and Zelda would lurch out, blue and twisted, her eyes rolled up to shiny whites, her black tongue puffing out through her lips, her hands hooked into claws to murder the murderer, cowering in her bed with her hands jammed into the small of her back. She had not attended Zelda's funeral, or any funeral since. "If you told me this before," Lewis said, "it would have explained a hell of a lot."
"Lou, I couldn't,"
she said simply. She sounded very sleepy now.
"Since then I've been, I guess, a little phobic on the subject."
"Just a little phobic," Lewis thought. "Yeah, right."
"I can't seem to help it. In my mind, I know you're right, that death is perfectly natural, good even. But what my mind knows and what happens inside me..."
"Yeah," he said.
"That day I blew up at you," she said. "I knew that Ellie was just crying over the idea, a way of getting used to it, but I couldn't help it. I'm sorry, Lewis."
"No apology needed," he said, stroking her hair. "But what the hell, I accept it anyway, if it'll make you feel better." She smiled.
"It does, you know? And I feel better. I feel as if I just sicked up something that's poisoned part of me for years."
"Maybe you have." Rachel's eyes slipped closed and then opened again, slowly.
"And don't blame it all on my father, Lewis, please. That was a terrible time for them. The bills, Zelda's bills, were sky high. My dad had missed his chance to expand into the suburbs, and the sales in the downtown store were off. On top of that, my mother was half crazy herself. Well, it all worked out. It was as if Zelda's death was the signal for good times to come around again. There had been a recession, but then the money loosened up and Daddy got his loan, and since then he's never looked back. But that's why they've always been possessive of me, I think. It's not just because I'm the only one left."
"It's guilt," Lewis said.
"Yes, I suppose. And you won't be mad at me if I'm sick when they bury Norma?"
"No, honey, I won't be mad." He paused and then took her hand.
"May I take Ellie?"
Her hand tightened in his.
"Oh, Lewis, I don't know," she said. "She's so young."
"She's known where babies come from for a year or more," he reminded her again. She was quiet for a long time, looking up at the ceiling and biting her lips.
"If you think it's best," she said finally. "If you think it won't hurt her."
"Come over here, Rachel," he said. And that night they slept back to stomach in Lewis's bed. And when she woke up trembling in the middle of the night, the Valium worn off, he soothed her with his hands and whispered in her ear that everything was okay. And she slept again.
33. "For man and woman is like the flowers in the valley, which bloom today and are tomorrow cast into the oven. The time of man is but a season. It cometh, and so it passeth away. Let us pray."
Ellie, resplendent in a navy blue dress bought especially for the occasion, dropped her head so abruptly that Lewis, sitting next to her in the pew, heard her neck creak. Ellie had been in few churches, and of course it was her first funeral. The combination had awed her to unaccustomed silence. For Lewis, it had been a rare occasion with his daughter, mostly blinded by his love for her, as he was by his love for Gage. He rarely observed her in a detached way. But today, he thought he was seeing what was almost a textbook case of the child nearing the end of life's first great developmental stage, an organism of almost pure curiosity, storing up information madly in almost endless circuits. Ellie had been quiet even when Judd, looking strange but elegant in his black suit and lace-up shoes — Lewis believed it was the first time he had ever seen him in anything but loafers or green rubber boots — had bent over, kissed her, and said,
"Glad you could come, honey. And I bet Norma is, too."
Ellie had gazed at him wide-eyed. Now the Methodist minister, Reverend Laughlin, was pronouncing the benediction, asking God to lift up his countenance upon them and give them peace. "Will the pallbearers come forward?" he asked. Lewis started to rise, and Ellie halted him, tugging his arm frantically. She looked scared.
Daddy,
she stage whispered.
Where are you going?
I'm one of the pallbearers, honey, Lewis said, sitting down beside her again for a moment and putting an arm around her shoulders. That means I'm going to help carry Norma out. There are four of us that are going to do it, me and two of Judd's nephews and Norma's brother.
Where will I find you?
Lewis glanced down front, the other three pallbearers had assembled there along with Judd. The rest of the congregation was filing out, some of them weeping.
If you just go out on the steps, I'll meet you there, he said. All right, Ellie?
Yes,
she said.
Just don't forget me.
No, I won't.
He got up again and she tugged his hand again.
Daddy?
What, babe?
Don't drop her,
Ellie whispered. Lewis joined the others, and Judd introduced him to the nephews, who were really second or third cousins, descendants of Judd's father's brother. They were big fellows in their 20s with a strong facial resemblance. Norma's brother was somewhere in his late 50s, Lewis guessed, and while the strain of a death in the family was on his face, he seemed to be bearing up well. Pleased to meet you all, Lewis said. He felt a trifle uncomfortable, an outsider in the family circle. They nodded at him.
Ellie okay? Judd asked and nodded to her. She was lingering in the vestibule, watching.
Sure, she just wants to make sure I don't go up in a puff of smoke, Lewis thought and almost smiled. But then that thought called up another one. Oz the Great and Terrible. And the smile died. Yes, I think so, Lewis said and raised a hand to her. She raised hers in return and went outside then in a swirl of navy blue dress. For a moment, Lewis was uneasily struck by how adult she looked. It was the sort of illusion, no matter how fleeting, that could give a man pause.
You guys ready? One of the nephews asked.
Lewis nodded. So did Norma's younger brother.
Take it easy with her,
Judd said. His voice had roughened. Then he turned away and walked slowly up the aisle with his head down. Lewis moved to the back left corner of the steel-gray American eternal coffin Judd had chosen for his wife. He laid hold of his runner and the four of them slowly carried Norma's coffin out into the bright, still cold February 1st. Someone, the church custodian, he supposed, had laid down a good bed of cinders over the slippery path of tamped snow. At the curb, a Cadillac hearse idled white exhaust into the winter air. The funeral director and his husky son stood beside it, watching them, ready to lend a hand if anyone, her brother, perhaps, should slip or flag. Judd stood beside him and watched as they slid the coffin inside.
Goodbye, Norma, he said and lit a cigarette. I'll see you in a while, old girl.
Lewis slipped an arm around Judd's shoulders, and Norma's brother stood close by on his other side, crowding the mortician and his son into the background. The burly nephews, or second cousins, or whatever they were, had already done a fade, the simple job of lifting and carrying done. They had grown distant from this part of the family. They had known the woman's face from photographs and a few duty visits, perhaps. Long afternoons spent in the parlor eating Norma's cookies and drinking Judd's beer, perhaps not really minding the old stories of times they had not lived through and people they had not known, but aware of things they could have been doing all the same. A car that could have been washed and turtle-waxed, a league bowling practice, maybe just sitting around the TV and watching a boxing match with some friends, and glad to be away when the duty was done. Judd's part of the family was in the past now as far as they were concerned. It was like an eroded planetoid drifting away from the main mass, dwindling, little more than a speck. The past. Pictures in an album. Old stories told in rooms that perhaps seemed too hot to them. They were not old. There was no arthritis in their joints. Their blood had not thinned. The past was runners to be gripped and hefted and later let go. After all, if the human body was an envelope to hold the human soul, God's letters to the universe, as most churches taught, then the American eternal coffin was an envelope to hold the human body, and to these husky young cousins or nephews or whatever they were, the past was just a dead letter to be filed away. God save the past, Lewis thought, and shivered for no good reason, other than that the day would come when he would be every bit unfamiliar to his own blood, his own grandchildren, if Ellie or Gage produced kids and he lived to see them. The focus shifted. Family lines degenerated. Young faces looking out of old photographs. God save the past, he thought again, and tightened his grip around the old man's shoulders. The ushers put the flowers into the back of the hearse. The electric rear window rose and thumped home in its socket. Lewis went back to where his daughter was, and they walked to the station wagon together, Lewis holding Ellie's arm so she wouldn't slip in her good shoes with the leather soles. Car engines were starting up.
Why are they putting on their lights, Daddy?
Ellie asked with mild wonder.
Why are they putting on their lights in the middle of the day?
They do it, Lewis began and heard the thickness in his own voice. To honor the dead, Ellie. He pulled out the knob that turned on the wagon's headlights. Come on. They were going home at last, the graveside ceremony over. Actually, it was held at the small Mount Hope Chapel. No grave would be dug for Norma until spring, when Ellie suddenly burst into tears. Lewis glanced at her, surprised, but not particularly alarmed.
Ellie, what is it?
No more cookies,
Ellie sobbed.
She made the best oatmeal cookies I ever ate, but she won't make them anymore because she's dead. Daddy, why do people have to be dead?
I don't really know, Lewis said. To make room for all the new people, I guess. Little people like you and your brother Gage.
I'm never going to get married or do sex and have babies,
Ellie declared, crying harder than ever.
Then maybe it'll never happen to me. It's awful. It's mean.
But it's an end to suffering, Lewis said quietly. And as a doctor, I see a lot of suffering. One of the reasons I wanted the job at the university was because I got sick of looking at it day in and day out. Young people quite often have pain, bad pain even, but that's not quite the same as suffering. He paused. Believe it or not, honey, when people get very old, death doesn't always look so bad or so scary as it seems to you. And you have years and years and years ahead of you. Ellie cried, and then she sniffed, and then she stopped. Before they got home, she asked if she could play the radio. Lewis said yes, and she found Shaken Stevens singing This Old House on WACZ. Soon she was singing along. When they got home, she went to her mother and prattled about the funeral. To Rachel's credit, she listened quietly, sympathetically, and supportively, although Lewis thought she looked pale and thoughtful. Then Ellie asked her if she knew how to make oatmeal cookies, and Rachel put away the piece of knitting she'd been doing and rose at once, as if she had been waiting for this, or something like it.
Yes, she said. Want to make a batch?
Yay! Ellie shouted. Can we really, Mom?
We can if your father will watch Gage for an hour. I'll watch him, Lewis said. With pleasure. Lewis spent the evening reading and making notes on a long article in the Duquesne Medical Digest. The old controversy concerning dissolving sutures had begun again. In the small world of those relatively few humans on Earth concerned with stitching minor wounds, it appeared to be as endless as that old psychological squabbling point, nature versus nurture. He intended writing a dissenting letter this very night, proving that the writer's main contentions were specious. His case examples self-serving, his research almost criminally sloppy. In short, Lewis was looking forward, with high good humor, to blowing the stupid fuck right off the map. He was hunting around in the study bookcase for his copy of Troutman's Treatment of Wounds when Rachel came halfway down the stairs.
Coming up, Lewis?
I'll be a while, he glanced up at her. Everything all right?
They're deep asleep, both of them.
Lewis looked at her closely. Them, yeah, you're not.
I'm fine. Been reading.
You're okay? Really?
Yes,
she said and smiled.
I love you, Lewis.
Love you too, babe. He glanced at the bookcase, and there was Troutman, right where he had been all along. Lewis put his hand on the textbook.
Church brought a rat into the house while you and Ellie were gone, she said, and tried to smile.
Yuck, what a mess.
Geez, Rachel, I'm sorry.
He hoped he did not sound as guilty as, at that moment, he felt. It was bad. Rachel sat down on the stairs. In her pink flannel nightgown, her face cleaned of makeup and her forehead shining, her hair tied back into a short ponytail with a rubber band, she looked like a child.
I took care of it, she said. But do you know I had to beat that dumb cat out the door with the vacuum cleaner attachment before it would stop guarding the corpse? It growled at me. Church never growled at me before in his life. He seems different lately. Do you think he might have distemper or something, Lou?
No, Louis said slowly. But I'll take him to the vet if you want.
I guess it's all right, she said, and then looked at him nakedly. But would you come up? I know you're working, but...
Of course, he said, getting up as though it were nothing important at all. And really it wasn't. Except he knew now that the letter would never be written, because the parade has a way of moving on, and tomorrow would bring something new. But he had bought that rat, hadn't he? The rat that Church had brought in, surely clawed to bloody ribbons, its intestines dragging, its head perhaps gone. Yes, he had bought it. It was his rat.
Let's go to bed, he said, turning off the lights. He and Rachel went up the stairs together.
Lewis put his arm around her waist and loved her the best he could. But even as he entered into her, hard and erect, he was listening to the winter whine outside the front-traced windows, wondering about Church, the cat that used to belong to his daughter and now belonged to him. Wondering where it was and what it was stalking or killing. The soil of a man's heart is stonier, he thought, and the wind sang its bitter black song. And not so many miles distant, Norma Crandall, who had once knitted his daughter and son matching caps, lay in her gray steel American eternal coffin on a stone slab in a Mount Hope crypt. By now the white cotton the mortician would have used to stuff her cheeks would be turning black.
34. Ellie turned 6. She came home from kindergarten on her birthday with a paper hat askew on her head, several pictures friends had drawn of her, in the best of them Ellie looked like a friendly scarecrow, and baleful stories about spankings in the schoolyard during recess. The flu epidemic passed. They had to send 2 students to the EMMC in Bangor, and Surendra Hardu probably saved the life of one woefully sick freshman boy with the terrible name of Peter Humperton, who went into convulsions shortly after being admitted. Rachel developed a mild infatuation with the blonde bag boy at the A&P in Brewer, and rhapsodized to Lewis at night about how packed his jeans looked.
It's probably just toilet paper, she added.
Squeeze it sometime, Lewis suggested. If he screams, it's probably not. Rachel had laughed until she cried. The blue, still, sub-zero mini-season of February passed and brought on the alternating rains and freezes of March, potholes, and those orange roadside signs which pay homage to the great god, Bump. The immediate, personal, and most agonizing grief of Judd Crandall passed, that grief which the psychologists say begins about 3 days after the death of a loved one, and holds hard from 4 to 6 weeks in most cases, like that period of time New Englanders sometimes call deep winter. But time passes, and time welds one state of human feeling into another, until they become something like a rainbow. Strong grief becomes a softer, more mellow grief. Mellow grief becomes mourning. Mourning, at last, becomes remembrance. A process that may take from 6 months to 3 years and still be considered normal. The day of Gage's first haircut came and passed, and when Lewis saw his son's hair growing in darker, he joked about it and did his own mourning, but only in his heart.
Spring came, and it stayed a while. 35. Lewis Creed came to believe that the last really